Hi, and welcome to episode 4 of Debunked. I'm Tim Light, I'm the host. The myth we are going to debunk today is only elderly and immunocompromised individuals are at risk of adverse outcomes from COVID-19. Today on the show, we have Paul Harkin, Michelle Chappuis, and Dr. Nathan Allen. Paul, do you want to start?
Hey, I'm Paul Harkin, and I'm here for the Voice of Harm Reduction. I've been working in harm reduction for 23 years in the USA, particularly in programs like syringe access, street outreach, overdose prevention, HIV, hepatitis C, and STI, focusing on working with marginalized populations and finding innovative ways to engage them in care that often involve not coming into the four walls of the clinic, but still being able to show health improvements with those folks where they're at.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Paul. Michelle, do you want to go next?
My name is Michelle Chappuis. I'm a member of the Ute Indian Tribe. I'm a licensed substance use disorder counselor, and I'm working as a tribal opioid resource center outreach coordinator. So I'm working with all the tribes in the state of Utah, providing naloxone trainings, harm reduction education, and being there to help them with whatever it is they need.
Michelle is on our editorial board, and she does so much for our team. She's really amazing. All right, Dr. Allen, do you want to give us a little intro?
Sure. I'm Dr. Nathan Allen. I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician practicing in Montana. I'm also a fellowship-trained healthcare ethicist.
Thank you guys for those introductions. I really appreciate you being on the show today. About a week ago, week and a half ago, I was talking to some family members and friends who work in healthcare, and the things that I was hearing from these sources was that, you know, COVID-19 is not as cut and dry as it may appear, and that, you know, not only elderly people and immunocompromised people, they're not the only ones at risk. So I was hoping, Dr. Allen, can you tell us what age groups are becoming seriously ill with COVID-19? And, you know, are these seriously ill individuals always immunocompromised or having pre-existing morbidities before contracting COVID-19?
They're definitely not. And what we're seeing across the United States is that a very significant number of people, about 40% of the people who are sick enough to be hospitalized, are young people between the ages of 20 and 54. And about half of all of the people who get sick enough to require intensive care are younger than 65.
Gosh, that's staggering. It's not what I feel like I'm hearing on the mainstream. So thanks for telling us that. And you said that most of these people, or at least a portion of these people who become seriously ill, do not have comorbidities.
Yes. While those are certainly risk factors for becoming significantly ill, it's entirely possible for someone who has no major medical problems to become life-threateningly ill with COVID-19.
Wow. So what comes to mind when we think about this, as I'm talking to my team and as I'm thinking myself, I just think about those populations who are most at risk in general. And one population that really came to our attention was unsheltered or homeless populations. What are some of the unique factors, Paul, that you can see homeless people experiencing?
So that's a group that I particularly work with. And when we talk about physical distancing, you know, there really is a lot of privilege attached to physical distancing. You know, people who are living in, tents, encampments, it can be a challenge for them to reconfigure. In fact, reconfiguring might put people more at risk. So, you know, when, and having workers that are willing to go into the field and access those populations. People in shelters were, because of the nature of the volume of homelessness and people experiencing homelessness, they're often placed quite closely together. So, you know, cities have had to reevaluate the way they're going, spatially, that they're going to have people in shelter.
And then just the general challenges that have always been experienced with that population and access to things like testing and care.
So, and a lot of cities may have thought they had a plan, but as we've seen with even the national rollout of testing, the planning doesn't always pan out the way it's meant to. And there's been an abysmal rollout of testing in the United States. So think about that when you get right down to people who are experiencing homelessness.
Yeah, and are there any other things? I mean, I know you work a lot in harm reduction, so with individuals who might be homeless and who might also use drugs, What kind of other risk factors are you noticing in that population?
Yeah, well, you know, the risk for HIV,
Hep C, you know, exposure, and then the idea of still having to be able to access your treatment. None of that goes away while people are in the middle of a pandemic. So it's really important that those essential workforces are still able to go out into the field and provide sterile supplies for people, you know, give people naloxone. I mean, overdose risk really shoots up at a time like this because a lot of people go back to things that they know, which is people who may have been taking a time out of using, now they're back to using because of the stress factors. And so they may have a different tolerance to their substances. Also, the drug supply gets interrupted. So there's different levels of potency in the drugs that people are buying on the street, more contamination with fentanyl. So overdose risk spikes. So it's really important that we make sure we keep the community saturated with naloxone and education around overdose reversal at this time. It's a very big issue.
Yeah, you make a really good point about coping mechanisms and how that changes. Michelle, what are your thoughts on the coping mechanisms that now are being brought to the table during this crisis?
I think one of the key things is when we're looking at coping, we practice new coping methods, especially if we're in the process of changing our habits, changing our behaviors. But like Paul had mentioned, when we're faced with something that is so, this is a new thing that is happening, and it's happening in a global, you know, a global field, all of a sudden we're going to revert back to what we're familiar with, no matter how chaotic it is. Because if you look at it, you know, we're going to be in this place where life is chaotic. I'm going to go back to what is normal, what is easy for me. And those coping mechanisms, if you're using your substance as your distraction, which, you know, we all know substance use is, this is a prime, it's like the prime frosting on the cake, because we're going right back. Individuals will go right back to those coping mechanisms. But then it also comes down to, you know, of course, we know it's like with behavior. We know that people are in fight or flight modes because of the panic, whether it be in regards to their individual safety, environmental safety, family safety. When we flip our brains offline and we're in fight or flight, we're going back to what is familiar and what we've practiced over and over and over again. So when we're looking at coping is a behavior that we have developed over a long period of time. And so those pathways in our brain, those our tendencies to go back to old coping, it's easier. And so like Paul had mentioned, you know, with our community members and family members and, you know, our loved ones who are going through and seeking for a different lifestyle outside of their substance use, this time is like they need support. We need to be able to offer that support and be able to offer that encouragement. But that also comes down to us knowing what our own coping skills are, knowing how we are dealing with this also, because we can't necessarily help another person if we're not addressing some of our own coping, because we need to be able to support that and still be, you know, still be in a good place.
Yeah, you make such great points. It reminded me of last episode, Dr. Sandra Solzer, who is our project director, our program director. She said that she's made a personal initiative to call two people in her social circle every day to make sure that people have support during this time of social distancing, which we're trying to call physical distancing, because we want to make sure that people, you know, aren't necessarily socially isolating. They're still reaching out. They're still staying connected, building those relationships, but doing so remotely via technology and things. So we wanted to jump in and let you all know what the CDC recommendations are on social distancing. Quote, social distancing, also called physical distancing, means keeping space between yourself and other people outside of your home. To practice social or physical distancing, stay at least 6 feet or 2 meters from other people. Do not gather in groups, stay out of crowded places, and avoid mass gatherings. In addition to everyday steps to prevent COVID-19, keeping space between you and others is one of the best tools we have to avoid being exposed to this virus and slowing its spread locally and across the country and world. When COVID-19 is spreading in your area, everyone should limit close contact with individuals outside your household, indoor and outdoor spaces. Since people can spread the virus before they know they are sick, it is important to stay away from others when possible, even if you have no symptoms. Social distancing is especially important for people who are at high risk of getting very sick. Tips for social distancing. Follow guidance from authorities where you live. If you need to shop for food or medicine at the grocery store or pharmacy, stay at least 6 feet away from others. Use mail order for medications if possible. Consider a grocery delivery service. Cover your mouth and nose with a cloth face cover when around others, including when you have to go out in public, for example, to the grocery store. Stay at least 6 feet between yourself and others, even when you wear a face covering. Avoid large and small gatherings in private places and public spaces, such as a friend's house, parks, restaurants, shops, or any other place. This advice applies to people of any age, including teens and younger adults. Children should not have in-person play dates while school is out. Work from home when possible. If possible, avoid using any kind of public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. If you are a student or parent, talk to your school about options for digital/distance learning. Stay connected while staying away. It's very important to stay in touch with friends and family that don't live in your home. Call, video chat, or stay connected using social media. Everyone reacts differently to stressful situations, and having to socially distance yourself from someone you love can be difficult. Paul, you pointed out that some people are experiencing testing disparities. I wanted to ask Dr. Allen if, you know, are you experiencing, or any of your colleagues across the country experiencing, any of these testing disparities in hospitals and the ER?
I can give you a general overview of testing, and that's that the testing capability nationwide is not where any frontline physician wants it to be. That all of us want to be testing more patients, getting results to them more quickly, because getting diagnoses are what let us do the things we need to do to, you know, stop spread, to flatten the disease curve, and to prevent more people from getting sick. And so I think the medical community is pretty united in the desire to be able to test as many people as possible. Unfortunately, there are enormous barriers everywhere to the volume of testing that we would need to do that.
Thanks. Yeah, Paul, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's like the doctor was saying, you know, it's who knew that one of the pitfalls for the United States was with the affluence that we have was going to be that we didn't have proper diagnostic testing. And we're only now just acquiring antibody testing, which, as the doctor was saying, is essential to build up an epidemiology of this infection and look at who has got immunity so that they could be working in the field because they've been previously infected. So the initial setback of those 4 to 6 weeks of inaction and ineptitude around testing has really cost this nation. And I mean, we do have to look forward and look at how can we'll never get it back completely, but we've got to be positive about getting testing into the community, because that's part of surveillance. And that's how we can isolate people who are infected, and we can get people who are immune back into the field working.
And without risk of communicating the disease.
So it's there's a lot that still has to happen. And it's shocking that we're this far in and we're still nowhere near
the testing that's required. That's a national disgrace, frankly.
Yeah, so going back to the myth, you know, that only elderly and immunocompromised people are at risk. If we're experiencing a testing disparity across the country, and it seems like it's an issue globally as well, seems like it caught a lot of people off guard. You know, that puts a lot of people at risk if we can't get those testing, you know, done and out. Michelle, I wanted to ask you about the situation with some of the tribes in Utah. How is it at Fort Duchesne and with the Ute Mountain Ute tribe?
So I know a lot of our tribal communities have, as soon as they found out it was spreading, that COVID was spreading, they started doing, you know, started closing down and encouraging social distancing. Within my own tribe, it was just on Monday that they had put us into, all the employees are on administrative leave, except for the essentials, the very, very minimal essentials. And then we have a grocery store. And so our grocery store is still up and going, but they installed the plexiglass around the cashiers to help protect the cashiers, because they understand how important our grocery store workers are, you know, with what's going on. They've got signs up on the road that say stay home, social distancing. Then it said, then there's another one above it, and it says prevent the spread, wash your hands. And it's, I love it, because it's like, you know, it was very, then those have been up for about 2 weeks. The tribe is really taking some proactive steps, simply because I think as tribal communities, we know that our tribal communities are underserved, and that what we get is, you know, we're not at the top of the line in the reality, you know, we're kind of at the bottom. And so it's like our leaders are really advocating. And so the Paiute community, they've been doing online on their Facebook, on their social media, they've been having, you know, each one of their departments have been addressing the communities. I know with our Confederate Tribes of the Goshute, they have been, their leadership and their health board have been making sure that their tribal elders are getting the food and stuff that they need, along with our Skull Valley tribes. Down with our sister tribe down in Colorado, they've put a curfew up, you know, so there's a 7 to 7 curfew. They've blocked the road that goes actually into their reservation. So our tribal communities are really being, really advocating for the social distancing and for being safe. We can see what's, you know, we all know what's happening down in with the Dene Nation, our Navajo Nations, you know, they're being hit very severely with this. I think one of the best things that I've found is our tribes look out for our elders. That is always a priority. So not to do any sort of comparative, but it was before our local grocery stores, or before a lot of grocery stores started doing that specific time for elders or people with disabilities, you know, to go in and shop, our tribal communities that already established that, because our elders are such a priority, or they are what's left of our past and our, you know, and our culture and our tribes. And so they're so valuable. But I think tribes are really doing what they can, the best that they can, with the understanding that, you know, this is impactful.
Thanks, Michelle. That's beautiful to hear about the elders and what people are doing in that front. I wanted to ask, Dr. Allen, do you have any comments on the high-risk populations that we've been talking about?
When we're talking about the unsheltered population, it's a particularly vulnerable group related to COVID-19 because of the difficulty in accomplishing social distancing. It's not possible to stay at home when you don't have a home to stay at. And then this is also true for people who might become infected. And so within our community, we're looking at trying to create places where anybody, and certainly people who are unsheltered at baseline, would be able to stay if they get diagnosed with COVID-19 so that they can effectively quarantine away from other people in the community and recover there without further spreading infection.
So what do these places look like? Are they like tents set outside of the hospital? Are they convention centers? What does that look like?
So some places are creating plans to use convention centers or other large spaces for this. Right now, we're working with some of our other social organizations locally and area hotels to put people into rooms there where we can bring food to them on a daily basis, and people can recover or at present just wait for their test results to know what their diagnosis is if they're healthy enough to be outside of the hospital but need to be somewhere where they're able to successfully quarantine.
I'm so grateful that that is what's happening, that people are pulling together to do that. Paul, what's going on in, you were telling me earlier something about San Francisco.
So what we've seen is, you know, law enforcement and DPW doing sweeps of homeless encampments at this time, which was called out by community providers as really bad practice, bad public health And it led to some pressure on the city government to stop doing that and instead start looking at other ways of mitigating this crisis. So we've seen buildings being taken over to become extra shelter beds, like the Moscovy Center, a huge convention center that's supposed to become a shelter. Because as we, with physical distancing, we have to reduce the capacity of shelters and navigation centers, or people are just become, they're like in a giant petri dish. So that's happening. And then there's been some hotels that can be taken over for physical isolation or for quarantine. But I just feel like the plan hasn't been really well thought out, and like the staffing of it, who's in charge of it. There's things that are coming up that, that we could have been better prepared for when we do all these disaster preparedness workshops. And I fear terribly for the for people experiencing homelessness that we might see yet a massive outbreak. So far, I feel we've been very lucky, but given the proximity of a lot of people experiencing homelessness, it could be something that ravages that community. And I really hope we get it together, and I hope that we maintain our luck. But I do fear that population is at immense risk.
Yeah, so I'm grateful that we are at least taking some steps now. I want to jump over to facts from Dr. Allen about how people are responding to treatment when they're on, when they've contracted COVID-19. Specifically, you know, if an individual has to be put on a ventilator as a result of COVID-19, on average, how long are people on these ventilators, and what are some of the stats in terms of outcomes once people are put on a ventilator?
The people with COVID-19 who are requiring ventilators are the sickest patients with COVID-19, but their requirement for a ventilator is longer than what we see in other similar critical illnesses, of patients requiring up to 10 days of mechanical ventilation, being very unlikely to come off even within a week. And even with that, some really saddening figures on mortality, where once people are put on a ventilator, less than half of those people are likely to survive to discharge from the hospital.
Wow, that is sobering. It's completely sobering. So that means people, everyone listening to this podcast, you can't treat COVID-19 like it's nothing. We have to take steps now to lower that curve, flatten the curve. So we need to social distance. We need to take this seriously, because like Dr. Allen said, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Allen, but you said that 20 to 50 year olds are becoming seriously ill from COVID-19. And those people, many of them do not have comorbidities.
Yes, it's possible for anybody to become critically ill. While the likelihood of that is higher if you're older or if you have other medical problems, nobody is completely safe from this disease. And almost everyone knows somebody who's older or who has other medical comorbidities who they care about. And that's really important for people to know, that this is why we are asking people to stay home to save lives, and why we're asking people to make that sacrifice. And we know in the medical community that that's an enormous sacrifice, but it can help save their life. It can help save the lives of their loved ones. And it can buy us the time in healthcare to expand our testing capability, our treatment capability, and to prevent hospitals from being overrun and ensure that as many people have as good of an outcome as possible.
Thank you. Michelle mentioned about the grocery stores that the cashiers are having plexiglass. Is that what you said? Plexiglass put around the cash registers and stuff so that they're protected?
Yeah, like a safety shield type concept.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a good example of some of the personal protective equipment that's being utilized. I reached out to one of our listeners who works at a grocery store, and they've asked that to remain anonymous and for the place that they work to remain anonymous. But they have told me that I can share that they work for a Kroger-based company so that that company can get some, so that company can get credit for the good things that are happening. So I asked a series of questions. The first question I asked was, has customer demographics or behaviors changed with the onset of COVID-19 pandemic? And in response to this question, they talked a lot about how in the beginning there was this rush on stores and, you know, they saw things being emptied off the shelves and it was really stressful. And they talked about how sometimes people were even angry at them. So this was the direct quote that they said. So they said, in the very beginning, everyone was pretty angry. It got to the point of me printing my own sign to place in my department, asking people to be patient with us because we're trying our best. I believe that was on the 14th. And by the end of that day, people had started being nicer to us, thanking us for doing what we do. Then they also went on to say this, the more I'm told I'm essential or a hero, though, the less I believe it. Many of us are working paycheck to paycheck, but only now we're regarded as people. I think this is a really important moment for us to reflect on how we treat people in general, but also how we treat, you know, especially people who work at the grocery store and who do other jobs similar to that, where, you know, it's easy to walk by and not say thank you. And it's not easy to walk by and not smile. But I hope that we're learning, you know, from these experiences that, man, people who work at the grocery store are completely essential. They are essential for the majority of Americans. That's just how it is. And we need to treat them that way. We need to treat them with respect and humanity, especially at this time with COVID-19. They are on the front lines. They're working hard and they're working in a dangerous environment, high risk environment, where they're exposed to the public, you know, daily. That's a lot to handle. So I asked our contact, I said, what kind of mental toll is this taking on you? And they said that when they were experiencing shelves empty before their eyes, they said they experienced a 150% increase in sales. And they sold out of most everything in 7 hours. I mean, can you even imagine how frightening it must have been for them to see the shelves just empty before their eyes? And, you know, how helpless they must have felt seeing those shelves empty and not be able to do anything about it. You know, they said that it was anxiety inducing at the time, but right now they're sort of feeling like this calm before the storm sort of anxiety. It's calmed down. You know, things are a little calmer. People are being nice again, but they feel like this is the calm before the storm. And so again, please, if you go to the grocery store, when you go there rarely, because right now we're supposed to be physically distancing, right? When you go to the grocery store, remember what these people are sacrificing so that you can buy food. It's incredibly important that we remember this. I asked them what precautions they're taking to clean the food and the store. Quote, they said, I'm pretty fortunate that I work for a company that takes food safety pretty seriously. Food-wise, we've shut down all open air service cases, as well as things like bulk items, donuts, etc. We have a third-party company come through on a regular basis to check on all our food safety. We've started opening our stores at a later hour and closing them 4 hours earlier. Some of that has to do with being able to stock the shelves, but a lot of that has to do with cleaning, and a lot of the new hires are just there for cleaning. We have someone whose sole job is just to clean and sanitize carts and baskets. We have employees whose only job is to clean the check stands and belts. So again, we need to applaud our grocery stores. They're doing great work and they're working overtime. They go on to say that they personally know people who've put in 98-hour weeks just so that people can have food, right? I mean, not just, such a huge, important job. But they, you know, there are grocery store workers putting in almost 100 hours in a week to make sure that the rest of us have what we need. They deserve more than a standing ovation. They deserve our respect and our empathy and our compassion as much as we can give them. Lastly, I asked this contact if they could share one thing with people in their store, what would it be? They said, I actually do care. I do try my hardest. I recognize you. I know who you are. And I am looking forward to seeing you on your shopping day. When I don't have anything, I feel pretty bad I can't help you. And during this time, some of you have really made me feel like I should feel bad. But I need you to remember that we're still people. We are just as freaked out about this as you are. Some of us are more freaked out than ever because we feel like it's just a matter of time before we get it. So again, please, please keep our grocery store workers in mind. They are another one of these high-risk populations that we're talking about during this conversation today. Paul, in your work, what's being done in terms of personal protective equipment to make sure that not only the people that you're serving are staying safe, but also that your coworkers and colleagues are as well?
Yeah. So as everybody knows, there's been a dearth of supplies for PPE. People are recycling PPE.
People are using improvised masks. Generally speaking, providers were not initially wearing masks.
Unless they were working with, we were given the mask to the person who had symptoms just because of the scarcity.
But as we've been going out in the field and doing outreach,
Now the providers are wearing, the masks as well. And,
there's not
enough masks. People, when you see like hospital workers, in bin liner bags, like garbage bags for gowns, it's unbelievable that we're so far behind. And of course, we must prioritize the most productive medical workers that are working with people at the most acute risk. So, the mask rollout, I feel, has been very, very slow because there isn't any. And
until there is enough
that, they're not even being used in the correct manner where people are using a mask for the whole day, whereas previously you were using a mask per patient. So all of these things may result in unnecessary infections due to lack of preparedness. And again, that's another tragedy.
When you're looking at homeless,
people experiencing homelessness, there are people just using bandanas. They may help reduce the sort of aerosol of the virus, but it's totally inadequate, and we need to get to a better place. But in a harm reduction perspective, anything's better than nothing. And we're just making sure people are educated about physical distancing the best they can, making sure that if folks are symptomatic, that we try and get, the callers, we'll take them to a treatment center and try and make sure that they access medical care. But none of this is really working in the ideal fashion because there's a definite level of unpreparedness at every layer. And if you think about, if you're Joe Biden or if you're, what's the name, Ron Paul, who tested positive, you're going to get tested and you're going to get medical care. But when you're, when you're in the lower marginalized populations, the odds of proper care are reduced dramatically. And that's part of health inequity in the USA. And it does show you the need for a much more equitable system. I mean, your treatment shouldn't depend on your income and your status in an ethical country.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you on that. Dr. Allen, what is the PPE situation looking like for you and your colleagues?
Nationally, there isn't enough PPE, even in local environments where people haven't been as hard hit by the virus yet. People are still reusing masks, finding ways to attempt to sterilize them so they can continue to be reused, or improvising equipment. People both need the PPE to keep them safe, and they need the assurance that it's not going to run out. I think it's one of the most pressing issues nationally and for emergency physicians all over the country is getting us the personal protective equipment or PPE that we need in order to take care of people with this virus and stay healthy ourselves. And those risks are real. Last night, the first emergency physician so far in the country died from symptoms consistent with COVID-19. And I am afraid that they won't be the last. And it is an enormous area of concern for healthcare workers.
Again, that's sobering. Michelle, can you talk to us a little bit about, you talked about coping before. Can you tell us how you are personally coping and maybe, share some of the things that you're going through with this virus?
Certainly. So when this whole thing started, one of the biggest issues that I have is, so I have a mother. I mean, we all have mothers. So my mom is a dialysis patient. And I'm the one who transports her to dialysis 3 times a week. And I've been doing that for the past 5 years. And so the biggest red flag for me is it's like, okay, I have to keep myself healthy. I have to keep myself in a place that I can still take her to her dialysis, because this is not just an option in life. This is not, oh, mom, you can't go because I'm sick. This is, you know, she has to have this. And then on top of that, it's like, okay, if I'm not listening to the recommendations to help keep myself healthy, then I am putting not only her at risk, but every other patient, individual that is in that room who is going through dialysis. And then if I'm having symptoms and I've not, you know, and I've been engaging in behavior that could put me at risk, and those symptoms are not presenting themselves, that is going to not just affect the people in that session, but we're looking at for the rest of the day, right? And we're looking at staff. We're looking at this high impact. And so, you know, for me, it's really stopping and seeing, you know, sure, I would love to be able to go have some Mexican food right now. That sounds yummy, right? I would love to be able to go, and I have a daughter who lives out on the Wasatch Front, to go visit her, but the risk is too great. And so I've really had to challenge some of my own behaviors. And you and I had talked about this yesterday, that flattening that curve is really about looking at what your own behaviors are. Because if your behaviors, if you are minimizing or justifying anything that you're doing in order to continue to do what you've done prior to all of this, it's dangerous. I mean, that's the reality of it all, right? It's like, we can justify, we can joke about it. We can say, oh yeah, this is not in my backyard. This is not in my neighborhood. This is not on my reservation. So I don't need to take these precautions. Even though we have such, I mean, there's evidence, we see numbers, we see actual, this is right in front of us, but yet people are still having such struggle with breaking those behaviors and those habits of having things so accessible. You know, having, so this is not my issue. And so even when we talk about the PPE, you know, the shortage of that equipment, it's like, if people would follow the recommendations, if they're to the best of their ability, that is going, we talked about, you know, dropping down that curve, flattening that curve, those two play a part. But if we continue to feel that this is not, that I'm not part of this dynamic, we are continuing to perpetuate, you know, through our own behavior. So for me, coping, you know, back to your original question, it's like, yeah, I've really had to address my own stuff. I don't know how many times I just wanted to get in my truck and go drive somewhere, go to the store, but it's not possible. You have to stop and think, because my impact, my contact to anybody is greater than just, oh, it's just me. And so, you know, to share a little bit, my daughter actually was presenting symptoms for COVID-19, and she lives on the Wasatch Front. And she went in and got her testing.
For those people who don't know, how far is the Wasatch Front from you?
Oh, so she's about three hours away from me. And she's my only child, and I'm a single mom. And I'm like, you know, when you're like that, it's like your life is about your child, even though she's an adult. So when she told me on Sunday that she was presenting symptoms, that was difficult, because my first initial thought was, you know, I needed to get out there and I need to take care of her. And not only that, but she's in the major area of where a lot of these confirmed diagnoses are, in the Magna West Valley area. And then to top that off, she's like 1.5 miles away from the earthquake epicenter that happened a couple weeks ago. So all my red flags are popping up. But, you know, to sit here and realize that I can't go out there, because if I go out there, I risk my mother. If I risk my mother, then I'm risking everybody else. And then it just can fly out there. So, you know, I've really had to engage in some, practice those coping mechanisms, practice the things that I teach.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in on that a little bit, because I think everyone everywhere is experiencing really tremendous levels of stress right now, and trying to figure out how to do self-care productively and not go, you know, to things that would be bad for your health, or, you know, high risk then, you know, to other people, or aren't consistent with trying to stay home and save lives is a real challenge, you know, for a lot of people. For my family, you know, I'm a physician. My wife's actually a physician as well, and she's a pediatrician, and she's coming to work too and taking care of other people. And that creates really unique challenges for us at home. And we have three young kids, and trying to do homeschool with them now, both continue working and doing that in a manner that's responsible, which means not bringing in other outside help and trying to, you know, limit going out of the house and otherwise is challenging. And then I can see those effects on my family as well too. And so are looking at the kind of things that we can do to stay mentally healthy as well while this situation is going on, because it has a real high probability of needing to continue like this for a while.
So Dr. Allen, what are you doing to stay mentally healthy?
I am trying to find things to feel happy about and to celebrate at work and otherwise, circulating those positive stories from our team. We were really lucky yesterday at our hospital. We got a really nice letter from a young teenage patient who wrote in and just talked about how thankful she was for everything that the physicians and nurses were doing and how we were inspiring her to stay home and to help stop disease spread. And she was actually willing to record that and put that out onto public social media for that. And so it was really uplifting to be able to share some positive messages as well. You know, at home, with our kids, we're trying to do good family activities. We're trying to, you know, every night either do some family yoga together as a family or just be silly and put on some music and all dance around together. Just something to try to make sure that we're creating positive situations in addition to the stress of what's going on, because I know my children pick up on that from what I bring home and what my wife brings home as well.
Thank you. So we wanted to jump in real quick to allow our team's holistic health liaison, Susie Baker, to give us some tips regarding self-care during this time of social distancing.
Thanks, Tim. I'm here to give you guys, just like Tim said, just a couple of tips and some practices, tools that will help you guys during this time of intense stress. I know we've all kind of found ourselves in a situation that none of us were expecting. And oftentimes the body can react in ways that we also weren't expecting. So, I mean, for myself, I've noticed that this has never happened to me in my life, but I've been like breaking out in hives at times. And I know it's from, and it's just subtle, but I know it's from intense anxiety. And again, that's something that I've never experienced until now. So that's just one example of how the body does react physically to emotional, you know, buildup or stuff that's going on. So for me, the things that combat that and really help are mindfulness practices, specifically gratitude check-ins, and meditation. Obviously yoga as well. So if you're able to move your body, that helps as well. But I would say, I mean, don't be too hard on yourself, but definitely schedule out times throughout your day that you can sit and tune inward. So it doesn't matter. You don't have to be cross-legged or you don't have to make it anything fancy, but just sit down, listen to your breath, and notice your breath inside your body. And you can start with 5 minutes doing that. I mean, 1 minute, you know, because a lot of us aren't used to these kinds of practices. We're just so used to our busy lives and going constantly. So it might be new, but start somewhere small and then build up. But you're just sitting and you're just closing the eyes and noticing the breath coming in and out of your body. And that's it. So that's just a form of mindfulness meditation right there, and just noticing the breath. And then again, if you're able to, you know, incorporate some sort of physical yoga practice into your day, also very important, because you're naturally breathing a little bit heavier through your physical practice. You're moving your body, super important. And I know that pretty much every local yoga studio that I've taught at, they are all offering online Zoom classes. And you will find online Zoom classes that you can participate in. And I know a lot of teachers on Instagram are offering free live classes on their platforms. And we as well, I have a couple meditation practices on our Instagram and Facebook. So check those out as well on our social media. Those are just a couple of practices. I wanted to share one specific practice that is centered around respiratory health. And some of you may have heard of it. It's called pranayama. So in yoga, we have asanas, which are the physical practices, you know, downward dog and all the poses that we do. And then we have pranayama, which is just breath exercises. So I want to share, we'll add this link to our social media after, but it's just on yogajournal.com, and it's yogajournal.com/poses/types/pranayama. So I know that's kind of long, but look it up. And this will give you about 8 different breathing exercises. It's really simple, but it helps lung capacity. It expands, and yeah, really, really important. Kind of in ancient Indian culture, they believe that the breath is like the direct source of life vitality, which, you know, we could really use some of that during this time, especially with this virus. And so, yeah, so check that out. And those are just a couple of tools that I think could really help you guys, all of us out during this time. They've helped me out.
Dr. Allen, you mentioned a few things, you know, about what you are doing, what precautions you're taking as a physician. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you are doing to keep yourself safe, your family safe, the community safe, and also, you know, what your colleagues are doing as well?
Sure. You know, to stay personally safe, I'm going to tell you that, you know, healthcare workers are being really rigorous about screening ourselves for symptoms and stepping back out of the workforce if we feel like we're getting sick in order to get tested and make sure that we're not spreading disease. Emergency physicians, emergency nurses, other physicians and nurses all over the country, many are making plans to stay on a separate floor of their house or stay in a hotel or, you know, stay in a camper trailer if they happen to have one, so that they can try to protect their families as best they can from some of that, some of this risk. For me personally, and with my wife being a physician as well, that's not a solution that works for our family. But when I come home from work every night, I take off my dirty work clothes and those go straight into the washing machine and you know, and into the shower to try to limit whatever I can from bringing home to my children in that manner. We recently wrote a letter from the emergency physicians here at Billings Clinic and joined in by some of our other colleagues at the other emergency department in town to really help let the public know that everyone has a valuable role to play in fighting this pandemic and that staying home and saving lives works. And that we wrote it in part because people are talking about this thing, social distancing, right now. And that's a new word and it's a new concept. And so we wanted to put that into really easy to understand terms and to really try to drive home the value of what that brings us as a community.
And where can we find that letter? Is that on social media? Where is it at?
It is. We made a recording of it that can be found on YouTube. The article with the open letter was published in the Billings Gazette, and I'd be happy to send you links to all of that.
Great. Yeah, we'll definitely share that on our social media platforms. Paul, Michelle, Dr. Allen, do you have any last-minute thoughts that you want people to hear?
You can't stress enough the value of physical distancing. I put a graphic on Facebook, and it showed you just how you interrupt the networks of transmission, that if this many people stay home versus this many. And I think it just visually, it helped people realize that it's an exponential benefit to the community of the lack of transmissions just by withdrawing yourself from that sphere where the virus gets to transmit. And the other thing I'd just say is that the media is largely responsible for creating this illusion that young people were, you know, again, sometimes people hear what they want to hear. And it was that older folks with pre-existing conditions are more susceptible No one said young people weren't. And if you go right back to Wuhan, there were similar demographics being infected. So it's always been infecting people of that age, but people haven't really seen the demographics and the data. And there were some assumptions made, and you know, some loosey-goosey reporting helped a lot of young people feel like they were invulnerable. And that's where you get the whole people going to spring break partying on the beach because they're like, well, it's just the flu. Who cares if I get the flu every year? So unfortunately, that was also terribly mishandled, and it's caused a lot of infections that could have been prevented by more accurate information being presented at the onset.
Yeah, you know, as you say that, and as Michelle was talking and Dr. Allen, I kept thinking, people need to understand that every choice that we make right now, everywhere we go, everyone we come in contact with, has the potential to have a massive rippling effect, not only for our own health, but others as well. Dr. Allen, did you have a last minute thought?
Sure. I think other people got this right, right? People are very worried about getting sick. The best way not to get sick is to not get sick and to stay home and to help stop the spread and flatten the curve and do your part in reducing this pandemic and saving the lives of the people in your community.
Thank you, Dr. Allen. Michelle, do you want to have the last word?
Of course, I love the last word. I think with this whole thing, it's really important. You know, we talked about what this really is, the reality of what is going on. But I think, like Dr. Allen had talked about too, with what he's doing in regards to his family to help them make it and cope through this whole thing, you know, we need to remember that connection is still important as individuals in order for our own sanity, but also for the sanity for others to make it through things like this, where we do have to have social distancing, where we're not able to engage in normal behaviors. Connect with people. We have so many different ways that we can connect. Connection is key. Just because it will help us be able to, because we don't know how long this is actually going to happen. There are predictions. We can speculate. We can hope. But the reality is until we are told that this is safe, we need to be able to keep ourselves safe, not only mentally, but physically, but also if we know somebody who is struggling, make sure that we can still provide help. We can still provide that connection because this is a difficult time and people will revert back to old coping mechanisms. So like Paul had mentioned, you know, there's a spike. We're going to see there's a spike in engaging in old behavior. We're still dealing with substance use issues. We're still dealing with opioid use issues. Those are still there. We can do our part by connecting with those around us, helping people with engage in, you know, different coping mechanisms. For myself, I've offered it to, you know, I put it out there on Facebook all the time. I'm like, if anybody needs to talk remotely, you know how to get a hold of me. And so just that simple connection, because people will go stir crazy if you do not have connection. So, you know, just stay safe. It's about staying safe, but also staying mentally healthy. Because if you are mentally healthy, you're going to be thinking rationally, and you're going to be able to make rational choices and decisions in regards to what's going on now.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Today, we were joined by Michelle Chapuis, Paul Harkin, Dr. Nathan Allen, Susie Baker, and our brave friend from the grocery store. To everyone who participated on this episode, thank you. Thank you all for everything you are doing to keep our communities safe. For mindfulness exercises, self-care tips, and updates on COVID-19, please visit our social media platforms at DebunkedPod. Also, look out for a weekly yoga schedule that will be live on @USU_health in collaboration with the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement. For the most up-to-date information regarding COVID-19, please visit cdc.gov, health.utah.gov, and who.int. Debunked is produced in collaboration with Utah Public Radio. Funding for the show comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement, and Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield. Our editorial board is Jay Hymas, Adam Baxter, Ashanti Moritz, Savannah Ely, Dr. Sandra Solzer, Dr. Suzanne Prevedel, Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, Mindy Vincent, Patrick Rizak, Michelle Chapuse, Dr. Maren Voss, Dr. Amy Kahn, Trisha Glass, Lloyd Arrive, Hilary Deesh, and Susie Baker. Debunked is produced by Nick Porath, Shalane Smith Needham, and Friend Weller, with Nick Porath serving as lead producer. Our creative specialist is Autumn Gibbs. Music for today's episode was created by Nick Porath. Our science advisor is Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, and our program directors are Dr. Sandra Solzer and Dr. Suzanne Prevedel. I'm Tim Light, host and editorial board member. You can find the show on the podcast app, Spotify, upr.org, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at DebunkedPod, or on our website at bit.ly/debunkedpod.